Good afternoon, Dan.
Hi, Mark. How's it going?
Very good, very good. Let's introduce ourselves. I'm Mark Schmidt. I'm a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, and I write a column in the New Republic and try to write as many other places as I can.
And I'm Dan Foster, news editor at National Review, online, I should say. And we're going to start by talking about somebody who I desperately hoped I'd never have to talk about ever again, which is Donald Trump. News,
I thought you were going to say George W. Bush.
No. Although he's in an ancillary way related to all this. Trump just went after Karl Rove today, calling him a loser, and among other things. that's after he called Bush evil in 2008. Now he's some sort of folk hero among a small but unfortunately real rump of the GOP primary electorate.
Right. You've got a good dossier on him.
Right, yeah. So he's agreed to or has been tapped to moderate a Newsmax debate in Iowa a week before the primary. So a debate potentially with some juice, although it's on the Ion channel, which I don't think is on many more is on many more cable boxes than whatever channel Keith Olbermann wound up on.
I don't know what Ion channel is. Is that a like conservative counterpart?
I have Ion, or I did growing up. It's like a kind of a Hallmarky. Yeah, it's a ABC Family sort of thing. Old family friendly movie reruns, things like that. I shouldn't go out on a limb too far in case I'm misrepresenting them, but that was my impression of it. So anyway, he's gonna moderate this debate, which I think is a terrible thing. And really, really bad for the...
Is he going to fire people at the end of it?
He's not going to fire people, but he is going to give an endorsement immediately after the debate. So it will very much have the feeling of a reality TV show, as if that were something that the GOP primary were lacking thus far.
Right.
I think all sides kind of agree that this is taken on a circus-like atmosphere, which was actually Ron Paul's words, and... The Ron Paul's campaign, bizarre as it is, had a perfectly spot-on, tonally perfect response to the Gingrich invite, and they RSVP'd in the negative. And his staff said basically, "This is."
You mean the Trump invite? You said the Gingrich invite.
Oh, I apologize. Yeah, I'm getting ahead of myself. The Trump invite. Ron Paul's campaign basically said this is beneath the presidency and beneath anybody who would serve that office, and that it's going to distract from the real issues and create, perpetuate this, as I said, circus-like atmosphere. And I think that is right on. And Trump is a guy, I'll just do a little spiel here because I really dislike this guy. I wrote a piece when there was this when he was supposedly exploring presidential bid, what seems like 50 years ago, but was sadly much more recently than that. And the opening anecdote of that piece, and I think it's kind of both a brilliant little piece of bluffing by Trump, but also really paradigmatic of the kind of guy he is that, he was developing, I forget whether it was the Taj Mahal in Atlantic City or one of his other casinos, but he was developing some big project and he was out of money. And he had barely any money he didn't have enough money to move forward. So what he did was he took the scraps that he had and he hired a bunch of BACO, major earth-moving machines, and he had them move dirt from one side of the lot to the other. And he would bring in investors, potential investors, and he would say, look, this thing is going 1,000 miles an hour. If you want to get in, you got to get in now or you're going to miss the train. So that was early in his career, and he pulled it off in that instance. And as we know, he's come back from half a dozen, 50, 60, 100 bankruptcies, who knows how many at this point. But the point of the piece that I wrote, and I think it's on fine display the last couple of days, is that this guy is first and foremost a bluffer. He bluffs. That's what he does for a living. And his exploration for a presidential race was a bluff. And you saw when he was flirting with running for office, the birther stuff, the really deplorable birther stuff that he flirted with. He claimed that he had gumshoes on the ground in Hawaii investigating the president's birth. I don't believe that was ever true. He said that he knows people in the White House who would be terrified of him running against Obama. Nobody believes that that's true. So the guy is, I won't say he's a liar because I think he's not particularly concerned about the truth. He just knows how rumors can move markets. I mean, that's kind of the basis of his career. And so just today we saw him, I saw a story in Huffington Post about him getting into a fight with Chuck Todd this morning. I don't know if you saw that, but if you watch the video, he's he's doing his impression of a conservative arguing with somebody on MSNBC, because he sees that arguing with somebody on MSNBC is the sort of thing you should do if you want to be well-liked by conservatives. And so he kind of apes getting ticked off at Chuck Todd, who I don't think anyone's ever been ticked off at ever, besides maybe Jay Carney. And he kind of right. yells at him and doesn't make much sense and kind of invents a conflict where there isn't one. And it's embarrassing. And his and to sum up, his presence, even on the periphery of the Republican Party, I think is embarrassing. And it's something that should be avoided by these candidates. I mean, I get the sense that we're not going to disagree much on this.
No, I'm not. I try. You know, I would love to be able to come up with a great defense of Donald Trump, but I really can't. Let me ask you something. Did he like create this debate, or did Newsmax approach him about moderating this debate?
Yeah, it sounds like Newsmax approached him about moderating it. And yeah. You know, Newsmax is an interesting vehicle. It's a big and well circulated, you know, attempt in print to right. create a kind of alternative to the mainstream media, though that's right. an overused term. And so a Newsmax debate in Iowa actually makes a lot of sense. I just don't know where, you know, Trump comes into it. And I just don't think there's any good reason for him to be there. I don't think he will make an effective moderator. I'm sympathetic to complaints my friends on the right that the moderation of a lot of these debates has been terrible, although the guy who I expected to be the worst was Wolf Blitzer, and I think he actually turned out to be the best moderator so far. So it's not
I thought he was fine. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not like you know, it's impossible to find a competent, interesting, and right. you know, balanced moderator in the mainstream media. But I'm sympathetic to the idea that okay, we should right. be looking for.
Well, one rule for a moderator, I should say. I mean, like the number one skill. Like I often moderate panels, and I think I'm pretty good at it. And the one thing you need to know to do that is like, you know, kind of check your ego out the door. You're not there to talk. You can interject in order to move a conversation along a little bit, but that's not your role. And I don't think Donald Trump would not be high on my list of people I think could play that
no.
somewhat passive role.
If he checked his ego at the door, the only thing that would be left
there'd
is
be nothing left. Right. I think that's good. But you know, I mean, the interesting thing is he has. It's interesting how the different ways. If you look at, you know, you think of him as having been a potential candidate. You know, the kind of business people who people in the Republican Party have been attracted to. You know, they none of them are quite the great, you know, entrepreneur, build a company up from scratch that you know is the sort of icon of Republican mythology. I mean, Trump, you know, he goes bankrupt all the time. It's all bluster. He actually makes more money putting his name on buildings that he doesn't actually build than he does as a builder. I mean, he's not really a significant. He's not in, you know, he's barely in the top 50 of New York real estate. You know, I think it's according to Cranes or one of those New York business things. He's really not a very significant developer anymore. But because he just does this, he just gets his name out there wherever he can. The name itself has some value, and that's all he's really selling at this point. And now he's selling it in various ways in the Republican Party or in the cable networks or in reality shows. You know, and then of course Romney made his money in an interesting way. That's not, I mean, there was a company that got built up, but mostly he was up. It was a company that invested in and either built up or pared down a lot of other companies. And Cain actually has the really traditional business career, although he really hasn't been in that business for almost 20 years since he took over the National Restaurant Association. So it's a funny, you know, the business icons are all interesting variations, I guess, on the model.
I would say about Cain, you know, Cain's time at Godfather Pizza being what it was, you know, it was a medium-sized sort of regional corporation. It was a big corporation, but it was,
right.
And he, by all accounts, did a fairly good job there. But he also spent a lot of time, as you said, as essentially a lobbyist. And people forget that he was a member of and then chairman of a regional Fed board.
Right.
So he spent plenty of time. That's kind of irked me about his whole campaign as being a Washington outsider. Well, if you were Washington outsider, you wouldn't have run for office three
right.
times. You know,
Restaurant Association.
Yeah. He lost a Republican primary. Flirted with a presidential run. In the past, and like you know, as you said, he was a lobbyist for so many years.
Well, it's that's much more egregious about Romney. You know, Romney says, "I've never had a political career," and the guy, you know, he he started running. He changed from independent to Republican in 1993 to run against Ted Kennedy, and he's basically been running for office ever since then, with, you know, a brief interlude to run the Salt Lake City Olympics.
Well, he ran in 94. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. He ran in 94 and lost, and then he didn't run again until he was elected governor of Massachusetts.
Until 2002, he didn't. Yeah. He didn't formally.
So I mean, Romney, I'll buy it, and I do think his model of success is more interesting than and more traditional also than Trump's. I mean, he was an innovator in the sense that he actually was one of the pioneers of that private equity model, the way that he would invest in companies. He laid off a bunch of people and all those familiar controversies. But Romney, I'll kind of give a pass on being a career politician. I think you'd have a lot more career politicians if these people had, you know, if it were easier to win office. So a lot of these guys, like Kane, Romney, you know, ran and lost. And so that's probably why he, you know, his resume is not as his political resume is not as long as even Romney would like it to be. Romney's going to be interesting to see with this Trump thing, because the big name. So Santorum and Bachman have said yes, and both those cases, as we say in our editorial at NRO this morning, both those cases are kind of understandable, if no less unfortunate, because Bachman's kind of sleeping in the bed that she made. She's been an avowed Trump fan for a while now. She's got to say yes. Santorum is not really in a position to say no to anybody.
Right. And both of them have staked everything on Iowa.
Say again?
Both of them have staked everything on Iowa.
Right. That's
it's Iowa or nothing for both of them.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That, you know, so this is at a particularly highly levered point pre-Iowa. Although, you know, somebody also made the point that it's on 2 days after Christmas. And again, on the Ion channel, which we may or may not, I may or may not be identifying correctly. So it might not be that, you know, might not see that big of an audience, but perhaps we'll see a really big audience in Iowa, we can only assume. But the really glaring one to me, and we can sort of swing to talking about Newt in general, is that Newt so early and so enthusiastically agreed to be a part of this debate, and more so, furthermore, he's kind of embraced Trump, and he met with him today, and Trump said their meeting went really well, and he's a smart guy, and Gingrich has said, how can you say no to the Donald, and everyone was making terrible jokes about this being a presidential apprentice, and Gingrich, you know, kind of obliviously said, think about it, this will be just like the presidential apprentice. So he's been almost inexplicably enthusiastic about this whole thing, and it fits into...
Well, they're similar characters. They're both blowhards.
Yeah, no, exactly.
And bluffers.
And I think, though, I mean, I see his angle. This whole Newt phenomenon is, I mean, really interesting. I think there's 1,000 different threads to pull on, but I guess his angle in the debate is that he knows he's a really good debater. He knows he's a threat to Romney in Iowa. And he's a threat to win Iowa, frankly, and that he's kind of daring, especially Romney, but all of his other opponents to say no when he's so quickly come out and embraced this and said yes. But just a real, I hope Romney says no. I hope everybody else who's still on the fence says no. But what's your take on Gingrich in general? I've been kind of trying to figure out publicly on the corner for the last month. Whether this is for real, whether it's explicable in the same terms as first Bachman, then Perry, then Kane, the anti-Mitt terms, or whether it's something fundamentally different as a political phenomenon. What's your take?
Well, I think it's I think it is a little different from you know, Bachman and Perry, which it was all just kind of the idea of them as somebody who was distinctly more conservative. I mean, it's very interesting to me because I don't think that Gingrich fits perfectly into the sort of classic Tea Party conservative mold. I mean, I'm not sure why they would trust him as a real conservative more than they would trust Romney. I mean, basically, you know, they both have the habit of whatever seems opportune at the moment is what's going to come out of their mouth. And that's not true for, obviously, for Bachman or Perry. And probably also not for Kane. You know, I don't know. I mean, why is it that somebody like, you know, Santorum's been in Iowa day in and day out? He's, you know, he's got the perfect profile. He served two full terms in the Senate. I mean, there's nothing obvious. He's not unqualified. He handles himself well. I think he's done fine in debates also. I don't like Rick Santorum, but you know, there's no, I don't know why it is that he just doesn't seem to have clicked at all in the state, and Gingrich has taken off. It can't be all that people are watching debates. I mean, maybe people are maybe either people are watching debates or the message is getting out that here Newt Gingrich, he's a guy who's, you know, handles himself perfectly and is a great alternative to Romney. But I'm not sure why it is.
I think that the Santorum thing, I agree with you that there's a kind of, there's a missing 10 or 15, you know, maybe 10% in the polls for Santorum that I really can't explain. I don't think he would ever been a favorite, and I think he's hurting a lot because in the debates he does come across as screechy and whiny and just really kind of berates everybody he gets a chance to, and I think that's mattered. But it's also the fact that his credentials are mainly on social conservative issues, and though that's, you know, always a big factor in Iowa, this is not a culture war election first and foremost. Right. But I do think that there's a missing handful of percentage points for Santorum that are really tough to account for. They should be there, especially at this point. Huntsman is an interesting case, too, because I never thought I'd see the day, and believe me, I don't think there's a Huntsman surge around the corner, but I never thought I'd see the day where prominent members of the right, especially blogosphere, are kind of tentatively, from Eric Erickson to James Pethakoukas to Ala Pundit, who's a really influential grassroots conservative pundit, they're all sort of saying, more or less, with more or less commitment and more or less passion, you know, well, maybe we should take a second look at Huntsman. I don't think it's going to happen.
Right.
But it is true that Huntsman's credentials are, and everyone knows this, are fairly conservative. I mean, I joked today that imagine if he also was very forceful in saying no to Trump. I mean, his campaign's response actually started out with LOL, their official on the record response. So he's been very forceful. And I said, you know, I kind of like that because I don't like Trump. We both don't like Trump, it seems. I kind of like that. But unfortunately, Huntsman didn't reserve his contempt for the likes of Donald Trump. He used it on about 98-99% of the GOP electorate. And if he hadn't just run this campaign of basically contempt for the base. And I know he's counting on New Hampshire and he's counting on open primary states, but, you know, that's not how you play this game. There's a reason why, you know, run right, tax center, you know, has always been the strategy to win as a Republican candidate. Right. So, I mean, but imagine if he had played the game right. But there's another version of that question you could ask about Gingrich, which is Gingrich, you know, landed face first when he launched his campaign. He spent a week in Hawaii spending fundraised dollars. Imagine if this guy, he lost three quarters of his staff. Imagine if he had actually been running for president. You know, every indication was that this guy was on a book tour.
Was on a book tour, exactly.
And imagine if he had actually been running for president.
Right, and I'm perfectly willing to believe that he started off on a book tour.
Yeah,
you know, but at some point, at some point, either it already has or it will kind of catch up with him. And I don't know what happens. I mean, if you have Romney actually competing in Iowa, which, you know, my general belief is nobody in both parties, people should never, you know, just stay out of Iowa. Mm. But, you have Romney actually competing in Iowa, and if Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul come in 1 and 2 in Iowa, where does the Romney campaign go? You know. Do they just, you know, run the table after that? I don't know.
It'll be really interesting because we already know that Gingrich won't be on the Missouri ballot.
We already know he missed some slates. Yeah.
And I hear, you know, rumblings that he won't be on a lot of, that he's missed a lot of other deadlines. And this gets back to, imagine if he were running for president. So if this turns into, I'm not convinced by the Obama-Hillary parallels that are quickly becoming the new narrative. I saw a couple things on that, but...
Right.
The parallel being that
Obama did a better job at that kind of ground, at dealing with the caucus states and that kind of ground level organizing.
Right, yeah, and just you know, and was able to represent something a little, and you know, kind of gave red meat to the base in a way that
right.
Hillary didn't, you know, and so I mean, this thing could go long. I mean, that's I would not have thought that. So that's why you know, as I said, I've been trying to publicly work, exercise my demons in understanding where Gingrich came from and what it means to the for the primary. But that's where I just don't know. I think on the one hand, it is the not Mitt thing, but in all of the previous iterations of it, it was, you know, the metaphor I use is like the guys you date versus the guy you marry, you know, and right. all the previous iterations, it was flirtations with these other candidates, and then as political gravity took right. effect, they were one by one brought to earth.
Right. Bachman to bed, Romney to wed.
there you go. I'm glad you said it, not me. And so, but an important part of that dynamic was that with each successive failure, I think the big block of the conservative electorate that was dissatisfied with Romney accustomed themselves more to the idea that they would hold their nose and go vote for him because he's, you know, maybe he seems like the most electable right. or just
that
the inevitable.
That did seem like it was happening. 3 weeks ago, that seemed like it was
that
happening.
Seemed like it was happening. So yeah. This is when I also asked the hypothetical question. Now, imagine that their roles had been reversed and I set up an elaborate, you can, you know, we'll have blogging heads put the little link to this post in the top right of your screen. So I won't go through the whole hypothetical, but I think it's really plausible that if a few things had changed and Gingrich had been running for president since 2006, and Romney emerged after a few years, you know, getting his Nixon on, being tan, rested, and ready, he would have become the anti-Newt. I mean, there are, I think, really conceivable close counterfactuals where Romney comes out and, you know, people think Newt's establishment and they think Romney's this
right.
interesting
oh, yeah.
executive.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's right. entirely plausible. So how to explain that? And I think he's catching some of that anti-Mitt or really just anti-inevitable candidate because
right.
the base is feeling frisky. But he's also, the danger of Newt is that even without political organization and even with all of the skeletons in his closet, he's smart enough that he might be able to pull this off. I mean, you might disagree with that. I know you don't think particularly highly of him. But, I mean, consider the fact that there's probably not one. We saw Coburn, who served with Newt, say bad things about him. We saw Lindsey Graham, who it's impossible to get him to say bad things about anyone, get kind of close to saying bad things about Newt, also served under him in the House. And Boehner is not nuts over him. Dick Armey hates his guts. There's there are a ton of people who served, you know, under Newt in the 94 Revolution that despise him.
Absolutely. And if there's any kind of Republican establishment, they are going, you know, they're saying we have to stop this thing. And we don't care if it can be Romney, it can be Huntsman, you know, we don't care.
Right. There's a whole bunch of people who are wishing that now they're, you know, that there is in fact a vast right-wing conspiracy and it gets to work dismantling Gingrich.
Right.
But I mean, and that'll make him really, I mean, you can only imagine how effective he'll be as a president dealing with Congress if we think President Obama's
right.
had a rough go of it. But I'm very...
I really don't want to think about President Gingrich. I think that's a very, very dangerous thing to think about.
Do you know that, from your point of view, you don't think it would at least be entertaining?
I think it would be very entertaining, but I do think we live in very scary times, and entertainment, you know, if you want entertainment, we can have Donald Trump. I really don't want an entertaining president.
Well, I'm torn, I mean, because I will buy this. So the standard line that reluctant Gingrich support, and the weird demographic, and just anecdotally from the emails that I get and the reader comments I read, the unusual demographic is that there are people who are very much aware that Gingrich is a consummate Washington insider, and who are very much anti-Romney because they think that he's an establishment
right.
hack. And so they've drawn this distinction between insiderdom and establishment. And what they're really ticked off about is not that anyone would have spent time in Washington. They're really ticked off that there would be a candidate anointed by party elites.
Right.
So in that scenario, the fact that people despise Gingrich in Washington becomes an asset for him.
Right. Right.
And I do think, and the most common argument I hear from these sorts of people is that, oh, we just want to see him, not we just, but we want to see him kick Obama's ass in debates, and we think that'll be really, you know, definitive, and he'll be able to set the, you know, articulate the ideas in a way that, you know, Romney can't. And that's, you know, that's why you saw this clamoring for Christie and this clamoring for Rubio, not just because they're, you know, interesting and compelling figures, but because they're very effective communicators, each in their own way. And so what you might see in the support for Gingrich is that we don't care if he's got 1,000 ideas a minute. You know, he can communicate them. He can communicate a kind of the broad contours of a vision in a way that we just don't think Romney can. And I think that's true. I mean, I'm not supposed to. I'm not supposed to back any candidates, and I haven't. And I take that, you know, fairly seriously. But I'm torn just from an analytical perspective on whether Gingrich could be a really formidable nominee. I mean, every bone in my body says no. He would make it a, you know, he would widen, you know, he'd make it a laugher. But
I mean, the guy had some incredible successes in his. You know, I worked on the Hill in '94. I remember all of it very well. And really, you know, was very much observed the rise of Gingrich. I mean, he definitely had some incredible successes, and part of it was. The thing that he's always been best at, actually, is actually challenging the Republican establishment to do things in a different way, which is not necessarily to be more conservative. I mean, one of the things that I always thought was very interesting about Gingrich's rise in the late 80s and early 90s was that a lot of his strong supporters were actually more moderate Republicans.
Mm.
You know, folks like Nancy Johnson from Connecticut. It wasn't that they didn't necessarily want their party to be more conservative, but they wanted it to be more lively and engaged and idea-driven than it was, and passionate than the sort of, you know, kind of complacent minority that it had been. And I always thought that was a very interesting element of his appeal. And obviously, what a lot of grassroots Republicans are looking for now is a stylistic challenge to the Republican establishment, which sometimes they can get it from inside, like from a Paul Ryan. But, you know, they're not interested in the world of John Boehner, I think.
No.
And I don't think it's necessarily that people could say, I want it to be more conservative in the following ways. But that they want an overall change of style, and a lot of that was. And the Contract for America, of course, was as much a promise of changing the way you did politics as it was specific. I mean, there was stuff in there that was substantive, like balanced budget amendment and so forth. But a lot of it was really just, you know, how you do business. So his kind of constant revolutionary mode, I think, is probably the most appealing thing about him.
I think that's exactly right. And you know, there's a parallel to this in the current race among Democrats, which is the kind of average Democrat's crush on John Huntsman. And I've thought that, you know, like I said, his credentials are fairly conservative, but he laughs at the same jokes that they laugh at, and he thinks global warming deniers are silly, and he went on Jon Stewart and did very well. And a lot of it is just style. I mean, that's...
Right.
And it's the same reason why Huntsman turns off the conservative base is the reason why the average Democrat who's watching this thing says, "Oh, why can't it be somebody sane and smart and reality based and slick and, you know, worldly like John Huntsman?"
My sane smart Republican candidate can't even get into the debates, which is Gary Johnson.
A Republican, you say, is he?
That's the one I have the crush on.
He's a rhino. I'm probably symptomatic of the conservative establishment in that I have absolutely nothing to say about Gary Johnson.
Nothing to say or nothing good to say?
No, nothing interesting to say. I don't have anything interesting to say. I mean, I barely know who Buddy Romer is.
Well, certainly not Buddy. I mean, Buddy Romer, you know, is crackpot political career from a long time ago.
Right.
I just find it real. I mean, here you have Gary Johnson, two terms as actually a quite popular governor of New Mexico, which is not, you know, it's not the biggest state in the country, but it's, you know, it's only a little bit smaller than Utah. And he did something that, he solved a problem, which is a hard problem to solve, which is how do you actually govern as a libertarian?
Right.
Maybe you can do it in New Hampshire, but, you know, maybe Montana, but a difficult state with a lot of poverty and a lot of different needs, and he actually managed to function as a libertarian. That, to me, that's a big deal. If I were a libertarian, I'm not a libertarian, but if I were, I would think this is totally awesome. I mean, Ron Paul just sat in Congress, and sure, you have votes and you have proposals to get rid of the Fed and things like that, but you never actually have to do anything in Congress. You don't actually have to govern. But Johnson actually did, and I don't know why it's so dismissed.
Well, I think that the people he would appeal to have already been satiated or in the tank for Ron Paul and have long been there and aren't going anywhere. I mean, Ron Paul has become a personality cult. It's not, he's not even the libertarian anymore. He is libertarianism. Right. Although there are plenty, you know, I think there are people around here at NR who would consider themselves libertarians before conservatives and who aren't Ron Paul fans. I mean,
right, and I think that's true of sort of the Reason crowd as well.
And you know, although Reason is certainly closer to Ron Paul in foreign policy than they are to us,
right? Absolutely.
And that's obviously one of our big beefs with Paul is just a kind of a dangerously naive foreign policy. But we don't have to get into all of that. So a part of me wants to see Gingrich as the nominee because just to see if he can pull it off. I mean, I've always described this race as a stoppable force meeting a movable object, and I've used this 1,000 times, but I think it's the perfect image. There's no reason structurally, given his popularity numbers, given the state of the economy, why Barack Obama should be reelected, and there's nobody among his opponents who inspires any confidence that he's the man to beat him. So it's this really weird scenario, and if you put a gun to my head, I'd say, you know, probably Obama wins a tight one. But I mean, maybe if Obama's gonna, if that's the most likely outcome, then why not, you know, say what the hell, roll the dice, and send world historic Newt out there and see what he can get done, you know?
Right. I mean, I could see that, assuming that if you need more than just the economy to move things forward. I mean, I still think from any Democrat's point of view, you know, the basic, you're still going to basically be more afraid that, assuming Romney can get to the nomination, and, you know, always stuns me how, you know, his numbers are just consistently really, really low. When he gets 24% in a poll, that's, you know, that's a high point for over the entire 6 years he's been running for president.
Right.
You know, usually bounces around in that 18% range, which is pretty astonishing for being the one, you know, the best known guy. Because, you know, he's on the cover of Parade magazine yesterday.
But correct me if I'm wrong, though. I mean, the 2008 Democratic primary kind of got laid early, right? I mean, as a point of comparison. I mean, the GOP field has kind of stayed at its current size, at least numerically, for the length of it, and everybody's had their little slice of the pie. You know, even Rick Perry, you know, and Bachman are hanging around, especially in Iowa, with fairly decent numbers. I mean, I do think that there's a lot of, and this is the dynamic we were talking about earlier. I can't not think that there's a lot of votes that are going to settle on Romney, not even as a second choice, but perhaps as a third choice. Gingrich also upsets that, you know, paradigm. I think, you know, Gingrich should be going balls to the wall trying to get Kane's endorsement because that's actually a real game changer, I think, especially in Iowa. But I still have to think that there's a lot of default Romney voters because that's the way these things shake out usually.
Right.
And people,
I just think with the default vote, you should be seeing a higher number than 18, 20, you know, really where he is, bouncing around somewhere between the high teens and the low 20s. That just seems really...
I mean, I always look at the state-based polls, and those are the only ones I really think are worth anyone's time. The national polls are... I don't understand why they're taken as seriously as they are, but...
Well, they get relevant after a while. I mean, they begin to line up with the state-based polls. It's you know, a couple months ago, their national polls are really irrelevant, but now they start to get relevant, I think.
No, that might be true. But, I mean, and that, the other thing is that people... So we have this issue with Gingrich being on all the ballots. Is he or isn't he? And we have, you know, the idea that, and people forget this, that a lot of these are open primaries. So are there going to be dissatisfied? Because we know how terribly Obama is doing with independents right now. And are there going to be dissatisfied independents who are going to show up and vote for someone like Romney or someone like Huntsman even? You know, what's going
to
happen on...
Right. It's hard to imagine the same... I mean, I know that group of independents in New Hampshire, they definitely, you know, they made McCain.
Right.
And I think... somebody I did Blogging Heads with, maybe you pointed out that McCain could not have won the nomination with Republicans alone. But, you know, McCain had a certain appeal to those independents that I'm not sure Romney has.
Right, but I think that there's a... You know, and nobody, it's almost like the silent majority. Nobody talks about it because the conservative part of the Republican base is the most fired up right now. But there's always been this silent majority, or silent plurality at least, in the Republican base that internalizes the "it's this guy's turn next" view that has always been the way Republicans pick presidential candidates. I mean, Bob Dole being the consummate product of that. So, I mean, I think that partially explains McCain, and that's a huge, I think, factor in terms of inertia, is the nasty way to put it, but momentum is the perhaps nicer way to put it for Romney. And I think it's real. I think that there are a lot more what you would call Rockefeller Republicans who vote in primaries than I think the average person sort of assumes when they're talking about the state of play. So I still have to think that Romney's the favorite, and if you look at Intrade, which is a highly flawed, obviously, marker for this sort of thing, but interesting to look at because it functions like a market. If you look at Intrade, when Romney was at 70-72% as recently as 3 weeks ago, and Gingrich, I think, was at 12%, and those numbers have come to near parity, and I think that's about right. I mean, I think that's reflective of where it is. I really do think it's close to a toss-up, but at the end of the day, I'm schizophrenic about it. I just realized that 10 seconds ago I said Romney's still got to be the favorite. I don't know. I mean, I'm supposed to offer something that approaches expert opinion on this, and it's just I really can't I can't wrap my mind around the shape that the race has taken.
Right. I mean, I just think Romney's an incredible. I mean, maybe I'm looking at it with the wrong eyes. You know, you talk about people, Democrats being like sort of comfortable with somebody like Huntsman. Maybe that's true. I mean, you know, but I don't think that it's just my effete liberalism that makes me just find Mitt Romney just a dislikable person. and I don't know. I mean, there's just nothing. There's a real lack of authenticity in a way that's it's not so much the shifting of positions. There's just nothing you can really grab onto and feel like he's a real person. I mean, I always think the example of when he says when his family sat down to to decide whether to run for president, and his wife Anne said, "Well, the thing is, Mitt, it's really just important for this country that we have somebody who's been a small businessman in the White House." And we're supposed to believe that was their breakfast table conversation, as if any married couple actually speaks like that to each other. I just think it's ridiculous, and I think he's just not. I just think there's a core sense in which he's just not really likable. That's really gonna kill him.
There was this Bret Baier interview that he did last week that he took a lot of crap for. And Jonah Goldberg here wrote, I think, a really good, and he was on the panel with Baier right after that interview, and he wrote a good take on it. And I thought it was a disastrous interview too. See, and I bring it up because I would have kind of mildly disagreed with you and thought, he's not the most likable guy, but he's so bland and so sort of unoffensive that I think that's enough against such a in an environment like this, against an incumbent who's got a lot of trouble. But that interview kind of showed the cracks in Romney, because it'd be one thing if he were just this milquetoast boring guy. And it was milquetoast all the way down, like they say, it's turtles all the way down. If it were milquetoast all the way down, but in fact he's got this little nasty streak that came out in the interview, and he was huffy and visibly annoyed. And Rich Lowry here pointed out that there was a moment where he kind of crossed his legs and smoothed his pants trousers and looked like the most annoyed person in the world with some of these questions Bret Baier was asking. As I put it, on immigration stuff, without even needing to get into the specifics of what his position was, I mean, he basically defending. He was describing a version of amnesty that he's supported in the past and continues to support, and then saying it wasn't amnesty. I mean, it was as bald and simple as that.
Right.
And he sounded on that issue, as I said at the time, the way Romney haters, caricaturize him as sounding, as a flip-flopper.
He has to explain and legalize every, he has to make everything actually fit together in these ways that don't make any sense, and then he gets a little huffy if you don't understand how it makes sense. To me, we'll get horrible comments about this, but, there was some truth to the Al Gore as, a little bit of a you know, both a flip-flopper and a kind of exaggerator about what he was up to, and a kind of legalizer, a kind of, you know, rationalizer. To me, Romney is Al Gore times 30, you know. On that kind of scale, and it's like, who are you, you know, you're an idiot if you don't understand how this position on global warming is compatible with this other position.
That might
be a little bit of his tone.
If that's true, it's definitely going to be relevant in the general, and I think Obama's going to be able to exploit it in the primary. Though, that's another interesting thing about the emergence of Gingrich, is that if we're talking about a two-man race, which is what it, you know, certainly looks like, then both the major knocks on Romney heretofore have to be neutralized. The whole, you know, Washington insider, you know, establishment type thing, that has to be neutralized, although somewhat mitigated, as I said, by the distinction between an insider and an establishment guy. And the flip-flopping thing has to be neutralized, especially on the individual mandate. I mean,
right.
Because Gingrich did, in fact, you know, support a federal mandate, whereas I actually kind of buy that. I mean, is it a semantic distinction? But it is. But in that Brett Baer interview, he said, you know, they have him quoted as saying, I'd like to see something like this tried throughout the nation or across the nation. Well, yeah. There's, you know, if you're a federalist, then there's actually a plausible reading of that, which he's saying exactly what he says what he says now he was saying then, which is that I think it might be a good solution for some other states, but I'd never try and impose it at the federal level.
Right.
So
right.
That.
But to grab onto the language where you say the mandate is, you know, an encroachment on liberty for individuals, it's not, you know, it's equally an encroachment on individuals whether it comes from your state government or your federal government.
Probably not the point in the conversation to get into an argument about federalism, but I mean, you know.
No, I mean, you can make a federalism argument. It just can't be the same kind of grand moral liberty argument that is now being made about the mandate.
Well, no, I just think that the farther away from you, and a lot of federalists think the same way, a lot of conservatives, I should say, who believe in federalism think the same way, that the farther away the government is from you, the less of a hold it should have on you, the less it should be able to force you to do.
Right.
And this is just not the sort of thing that federal governments are good at, micromanaging, you know, in the same way that they're not good at micromanaging education policy, or they're not good at micromanaging even welfare programs, and, you know, why I support block granting for Medicaid. You know, it's on a lot of these issues, and this is it's a real dynamic. It's not just a convenient, I don't think you'd probably disagree, but I don't think it's a convenient bit of political language. On a lot of these issues, you're seeing, you know, Paul Ryan, villain, you know, hero of the rich, evil, greedy Republicans, villain of the progressives, is basically not that, I mean, this might make your blood boil, but I think he's broadly similar vision of the important size and scope of the social safety net as Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I mean, I don't think we ran a cover. We ran a cover with Ryan as Roosevelt a few months ago. It's one of my favorites. And I think, you know, Ryan has said explicitly out loud, we need a well-tailored social safety net for the poor and the destitute and the people who can't help themselves. And that's sort of how, and so the federalism comes into play because, oh yeah, let's block grant Medicaid. Let's make more individual choice, you know, move towards premium support on Medicare. On education, let's get Washington out of the, you know, out of the back pocket of school board 126 in rural Texas. I mean, these are real federalist arguments. I don't think it's just convenient political language. And so, I you know, on the Romney thing, the real issue is whether Romney believes it. Because I think it's a perfectly valid distinction that he's making. So the knock on Romney is not that there's not a federalist argument for doing Romney care and opposing Obamacare. That is, I've always seen as a real viable argument. The question is,
and frankly, I think I do. I think I probably do too.
Yeah,
that there is an argument that says let Massachusetts try it, and then other states can do that if they want to. You know, if I wouldn't, it's not my argument, but yeah, that's legitimate.
Yeah, and so getting back to what we were talking about, the question for Romney is, does he buy it, or is he just saying what's necessary to say at the time? And you know, and I really don't know. But I thought that coming to Romney kind of late, because frankly, I'm, you know. I wasn't a Romney expert in 2008. You know, he was not my guy. I wasn't doing this every day for a living. So I've gotten to know Romney sort of retroactively and become more intimately familiar with him retroactively. I never saw the dislikable thing. I thought he's a nice-looking guy. Mm. He's, you know, kind of, you know, corny, but as Michael Barone, I think, made a great argument that he basically missed the 1960s culturally and right. and physically, in the sense that he was spending a lot of time in rural France in the 60s and at Brigham Young. So I never saw the dislikable piece of it, but there is it's so cliched at this point, but the robotic thing and the best example of it from that interview, which really I could write a dissertation on, is when Bear asks him what his favorite book is, or what he's reading right now. And Romney says, he smiles and he says, "Well, I'm reading a sort of fun one right now, so let's skip that. I just read Decision Points by George W. Bush." And as Jonas said, you're Mitt Romney. We want to hear about the fun book you read.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Instead, as Jonas said, it's like Romney bot was computing the exact right answer. Correct answer for the situation, and saying I was reading George W. Bush's autobiography.
Right.
So
that's
very frustrating, and you wonder if it's a matter of just not having the right strategist or what it is, or if there's somebody who can produce a more human version of Mitt Romney in the general. I don't know.
Right, right. I mean, you obviously have to show a little bit of yourself and what you're like. I noticed, I saw some fun, it was a fun Romney fact. So I was reading that, I was like taking out my recycling yesterday, and I actually pulled out Parade magazine, so I have a little...
Which is actually how 90% of Parade magazines are read.
Right, in that last stop before recycling. But I read this interview, and he one of the first things he talks about, he said it was a terrible example. He said, it was like, how did your father shape you? And he said, well, my father, he was CEO of American Motor Company, and when he released his tax returns when he was running for president, he, everybody knew he could have hired a landscaping company, but instead he made us kids mow the lawn and sweep the yard, which is actually sort of ridiculous, since we all know Mitt Romney did hire a landscaping company.
Mitt did.
Mitt did. His father didn't, but he it's like these values actually weren't necessarily replicated in the next generation. But the interesting thing was, I was curious about this, and I thought, it really, politicians didn't release their tax returns back in the 1960s. That wasn't something that anybody did. And my friend Rick Perlstein, I thought, would know about this, so I asked him about that over email. And he found an article that was totally unprecedented. George Romney released 12 years of his tax returns in 1967, I guess, when he was running for the 1968 nomination. And he released, in 12 years, as CEO of American Motor Company, he made a total in 12 years of $1.2 million in salary, which I just think is, what a bygone era.
net or gross?
Well, it was his reported income. Gross, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So
that wasn't after the 70% top marginal rate?
It was all pre-tax. I mean, that's what he was reporting. And nobody paid that anyway, as you know. But it's such a quaint era when... CEO would make their kids mow the lawn and barely make $100,000 a year.
That is interesting, but I think you would have to agree that that is a generational as opposed to an ideological distinction.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, we're a lot of the more ridiculous elements and less legitimate gripes of the Occupy Wall Street set have to do with things that these people's parents would not have complained about. That in fact they did for themselves. So I mean, whether it's working your way through college or going to community school so you can get a little bit better job, whatever it is, or the example you used, mowing the lawn. And the most successful people I know, though, are the ones who kind of cut against that grain. I mean, I think of one of my best childhood friends, who's a... If he's not a millionaire, he will be in about 30 seconds, and he's, my age, 27, Wall Street banker type, but you know what? He worked for the school board every summer, raking leaves and weeding and, mowing lawns. And that work ethic, I don't think is an... And he also voted for Obama in 2008. That work ethic, I don't think is an ideological thing. It's just something that we're seeing diminished, and I would... Just to leave.
Right. I don't either. I just thought it was funny that of all the examples he might use, that Romney picks the landscaping. And I think that's one of those things that there are times you do it, there are times you don't do it. There's nothing, I don't think it's ideological. I don't even think it's necessarily moral, but you shouldn't, you know, it is good, I think, for families not to take that for granted. I always say, you know, if I ever run for office, you know, my bio is going to say worked his way through college as a janitor, which is more or less technically true, so.
Oh, that's great, yeah.
But but I also think that's, you know, okay, so what? You know, and I'm not doing, you know, it's not like that's what I'm doing now or anything.
Right. Yeah. Well, on the subject of you working your way through college as a janitor, we should probably wrap this up.
It's slightly exaggerated, by the way.
Wait. So I want to know what was it?
I mean, you know, I worked as a janitor for about 4 or 5 weeks at the end of the semester, rather than working in the. You know, I worked full time as a janitor for a few weeks at the end of.
Yeah, it's better than my resume. I to my great shame, I've never waited a table,
I've never waited a table either.
My mother says that's a real character building experience, and she thinks that I should go and do it at some point. Maybe I will. I'll take a little leave of absence and do it. And as a result, I probably over tip all the time. There's a residual guilt at never having waited a table.
Well, I mean, I think people who do wait tables also say they over tip, and it's shocking. It's shocking how many people, you know, have a hard day's or evening's work. Completely shot by people not tipping, because the minimum wage for tipped industries is only, I think it's in the $2 range.
Yeah, it might be low threes. Yeah, but it is. Yeah, it is. I mean, I've you know, it's important to do that sort of manual labor, if only very briefly. You know, and I've done my share of lugging heavy things too, and that's why I consider myself blessed that I'm sitting in a moderately comfortable desk in a temperature controlled office.
We're all very fortunate, even if we're not necessarily in the 1%.
We are the 15%.
Or not in the 1% yet.
Right. Well, good talking to you.
Okay, nice to talk to you, Dad. Okay.
Mark, have a good one. Bye.
You too. Bye-bye.